UCCF's BeThinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Okay. Forgive us starting late. A very warm welcome to you, particularly those who are at the Apologetics Network for the very first time. Maybe you'd like to indicate who you are if you're at the Apologetics Network here for the first time. Hey, there's quite a number of you. You are very welcome indeed. Now, how many of you were expecting to be going into an introductory network just for the first day? Because that has actually been prepared, but Stefan and Lars were thinking, well, it's just going to seem a little bit terrible now. You've sat down, you're ready to hear Bill Craig taking you off like the Sunday school class going out before the sermon. So what we've proposed to do is for all of us to stay in what is ostensibly an advanced track, advanced only in as much as the people who are here have been to at least one other apologetics network in the past. And so there's an assumption about our values as a network, our aspirations. We've covered certain basic ground in the past here. It's not to say you guys who are here for the first time haven't covered all that ground and a lot more. But what we're thinking is we'd all stay together, introductory and advanced, and hear Bill's lecture. We're then going to take a break. There'll be time for questions and discussion. But before we finish, for about half an hour, we would take the folk here for the first time off for half an hour where you can just be filled in on some of the other things happening beyond this conference, what the values and the aspirations, the goals of the network are, rather than, you know, in one sense, give that to everybody else as well. They've had it for the past 2 years. Now, is everybody happy with that? That's good. So if you are genuinely new to this kind of thing, and some of this is just a bit too technical, just hold on in there, and just hold on to what you can. That's all I can do at situations like this. So I'm going to pray for us, particularly for Bill, and then Stefan will introduce this session and Bill's topic, and we'll get to work. So let's pray. Father, we do want to thank you so much for speaking to us through your word this morning. It is a great privilege to be addressed by the living God. And Lord, as we do seek to live lives worthy of you amongst our pagan contemporaries, we want to be salty, we want to be light. And we do recognize, Lord, that the God of this world, the prince of this world, has blinded the minds of men and women. And one of the greatest devices he's used is to suggest that there is absolutely no need for an intelligent designer behind this universe, that the whole worldview of naturalism seems to have made you in their minds redundant. And so we do thank you for Bill and for all the gifts you've given him, for the way in which he's disciplined his life to make a study of various areas, including cosmology and in particular this whole Big Bang discussion. And we do pray, Lord, that in this session together, we would be able to see the ground that is legitimately yours, and that we would be able to reclaim for the gospel truths that are important in this process of just knocking down strongholds and allowing the blindfolds of men and women to be removed to see the intelligent, awesome, creator God behind this universe. So, Lord, it's to that end that we now go into detail, that we really stretch our minds, that we really think deeply. Help us to love you with our minds as we spend this time together. Do particularly strengthen Bill as he has a grueling schedule. Pray that you'd help him to think quickly, to articulate clearly, and to answer our questions in the most honest and helpful way he can. Thank you for each other. Thank you for our time together. In Jesus' name, amen.
It's a great joy and privilege for me to welcome and introduce William Lane Craig, who is our speaker today. William Lane Craig is research professor at Talbot Theological School in California, and is one of the world's leading Christian apologists. He has written numerous books on a number of subjects. He has specialized, among other things, on the cosmological argument. And we are very pleased that you are here to lecture for us. I got to know Bill some years ago when he came to Sweden, lecturing and debating at a number of places in Sweden. And it was, for us, some really fantastic and joyous events, both the absolute excellence of the lectures and the debates, and also the serving spirit you had, Bill, traveling around amongst our student groups. So it had a deep impact on us, and we're really thankful. Personally, I'm also very thankful for your ministry and for your books. They have helped me greatly. So, welcome.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a delight to be here with you today and to share this seminar time with you. Last night, Vim reminded us of the anniversary of St. Boniface's preaching to the Frisians. And of course, today is also a very important anniversary. June 6, 1944, 60 years ago today, was the Allied invasion of the beaches of Normandy, D-Day, in which this Allied force hit the shores of France to liberate Europe from the terrible darkness of Nazi tyranny. And I think it's only appropriate that today we would pause to think of the sacrifice that those men made, as many gave their lives, so that we could live free and secure lives today. As I was lying in bed last night thinking about this, I was reminded of the movie Saving Private Ryan. And you may recall, for those of you who have seen the film, at the end, Private Ryan, now an old man, comes back to Normandy to see the grave sites of those who gave their lives to save him. And he falls on his knees as he approaches the graves and begins to sob uncontrollably. And his wife comes to his side to comfort him, and he stands up and he says to her, "Tell me that I've been a good man. Tell me I've been a good man." He wanted his life to, in one sense, ratify the sacrifice that those men had made. They had given their lives in order that he might live. And he wanted to be reassured that the life that he had lived in some measure justified the sacrifice that they had made. And it occurs to me that in a real sense, each one of us is Private Ryan, that those men gave their lives so that we might live lives of freedom and peace and security, not only in Europe, but in the rest of the world as well. And so we have a great deal, I think, to be thankful for as we think on the 60th anniversary of that remarkable day. And there's a spiritual application here as well, I thought, because today, 60 years later, we are also embarked on an operation, in a sense, to liberate Europe from a terrible darkness, the darkness of secularism and unbelief. And the struggle in which we are engaged is no less titanic and will require sacrifices as well, if it's to be won. And so I think this can be a kind of spiritual lesson for us as well, as we're engaged in this tremendous operation to liberate the entire continent of Europe from the darkness of unbelief. And may God give us strength and courage to be engaged in that task as soldiers in his army. Well, before we look at the talk today, I just want to say how much I admire those of you who are not native English speakers in coming to and participating in a conference like this. Having lived in Europe for 13 years in four different European countries, I know how difficult it can be to be in an atmosphere where you're not in your native language and you're working in a second or perhaps even third language. And so we applaud you for your efforts, for being here, and I just want to encourage you to keep it up. Don't give up. Keep working hard on that mastery of English. As the book table out there displays the resources that are available in the English language for us in apologetics is just of inestimable worth. And so it is just critical that you acquire and master these English language skills to make those resources available to you. Now, to help us today in understanding the talk, we have not only the outline, but I believe you should have an actual copy of the paper from which the outline is made in your notebooks. Do you all have that paper? It's called Naturalism and Cosmology. If you don't have that paper, you can just follow along on the outline, but I believe the paper is there as well. Is that right? No, you don't have that. Okay, Richard had showed me that he had it, but... Yes. Yes. Yeah, Beyond the Big Bang is the way this one is titled. It goes under different titles. So you can follow along with that if you want. That will help, I think, in for those of you for whom English is not the first language. In his biography of Ludwig Wittgenstein, the great Austrian philosopher, Norman Malcolm reports that Wittgenstein said that he sometimes had a certain experience which could best be described by saying that when I have it, I wonder at the existence of the world. I am then inclined to use such phrases as how extraordinary that anything should exist, or how extraordinary that the world should exist. This mystery, which according to Aristotle lay at the very root of philosophy, is one which even thoughtful naturalists cannot avoid. Derek Parfit, for example, agrees that no question is more sublime than why there is a universe, why there is anything rather than nothing. Well, as all of us know, this question led the great German philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz to posit the existence of a necessary being, which carries within itself the sufficient reason for its existence, and which constitutes the sufficient reason for the existence of everything else in the world. And Leibniz identified this necessary being as God. Naturalists, on the other hand, have typically claimed that the space-time universe itself is, at least factually, necessary. That is to say, eternal, uncaused, incorruptible, and indestructible. And they dismiss the demand for a logically necessary being. Thus, for example, David Hume queried, why may not the material universe be the necessarily existing being? Indeed, how can anything that exists from eternity have a cause, since that relation implies a priority in time and a beginning of existence? In Hume's thinking, there's just no warrant for going beyond the universe to posit a supernatural ground of its existence. As Bertrand Russell put it so succinctly in his famous BBC radio debate with Frederick Copleston, the universe is just there, and that's all. But is that really all? It was the presumed eternity of the universe which allowed naturalistic minds to rest comfortably in the face of the mystery of existence. And this feeling of comfort was first disturbed when in 1917, Albert Einstein made a cosmological application of his newly discovered gravitational theory, the general theory of relativity. Now, in so doing, Einstein assumed that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, that is to say, it's the same in all directions, and that it exists in a steady state with a constant mean mass density and a constant curvature of space. To his chagrin, however, he found that the general theory of relativity would not permit such a model of the universe unless he introduced into his gravitational field equations a certain fudge factor, symbolized by the Greek letter lambda, called the cosmological constant, in order to counterbalance the gravitational effect of matter and so ensure a static, eternal universe. Einstein's universe, however, was balanced on a razor's edge, and the least perturbation, even the transport of matter from one part of the universe to another, would upset this balance and cause the universe either to implode or to expand. By taking this feature of Einstein's model seriously, the Russian mathematician Alexander Friedmann and the Belgian astronomer Georges Lemaître were able to formulate independently in the 1920s solutions to the field equations of the general theory of relativity, which predicted an expanding universe. The monumental significance of the Friedmann-Lemaître model lay in its historization of the universe. It's giving the universe a history. As one commentator has remarked, up until this time, the idea of the expansion of the universe was absolutely beyond comprehension. Throughout all of human history, the universe was regarded as fixed and immutable, and the idea that it might actually be changing was inconceivable. But if the Friedmann-Lemaître model were correct, the universe could no longer be adequately treated as a static entity existing, in effect, timelessly. Rather, the universe has a history, and time will not be a matter of indifference when it comes to investigating the cosmos. In 1929, the American astronomer Edwin Hubble showed that the red shift in the optical spectra of light from distant galaxies was a common feature of all measured galaxies and was proportional to their distance from us. This red shift, which was first observed by Vesto Slipher in 1926, was taken to be a Doppler effect. It indicated the recessional motion of the light sources in the line of sight. That is to say, as the galaxies move away from us, the light from the galaxies is affected so that it appears to be redder than it should. And so this red shift is indicative of a universal recession of the galaxies throughout the universe. Incredibly, what Hubble had discovered was the isotropic expansion of the universe predicted by Friedmann and Lemaître on the basis of Einstein's general theory of relativity. It was a veritable turning point in the history of science. Of all the great predictions that science has ever made over the centuries, exclaims John Wheeler, was there ever one greater than this? To predict, and to predict correctly, and to predict against all expectation, a phenomenon so fantastic as the expansion of the universe. So according to the Friedmann-Lemaître model, as time proceeds, the distance separating material particles becomes greater. And it's important to understand that as a theory based in the general theory of relativity, the Friedmann-Lemaître model does not describe the expansion of the universe into a pre-existing, empty Newtonian space or container, but rather it describes the expansion of space itself. The ideal particles of the cosmological fluid, which are constituted by the matter and energy of the universe, are actually conceived to be at rest with respect to space. They are actually at rest in space. but they recede progressively from one another as space itself expands or stretches. Just as buttons glued to the surface of a balloon would recede from one another as the balloon inflates. As the universe expands, it becomes less and less dense. Now, this has the astonishing implication that as one reverses the expansion and goes back in time, the universe becomes progressively denser and denser and denser until one finally arrives at a state of infinite density at some point in the finite past. This state represents a singularity at which space-time curvature, along with temperature, pressure, and density, becomes infinite. And it therefore constitutes an edge or a boundary to space-time itself. The British physicist P.C.W. Davies comments, "If we extrapolate this prediction to its extreme, we reach a point when all distances in the universe have shrunk to zero. An initial cosmological singularity therefore forms a past temporal extremity to the universe. We cannot continue physical reasoning or even the concept of space-time through such an extremity. For this reason, most cosmologists think of the initial singularity as the beginning of the universe. On this view, the Big Bang represents the creation event, the creation not only of all the matter and energy in the universe, but also of space-time itself." And thus the term Big Bang, which was originally a derisive expression coined by Fred Hoyle to characterize the beginning of the universe predicted by the Friedmann-Lemaître model, is potentially a misleading expression because the expansion cannot be visualized from the outside like an explosion, because there is no outside, just as there is no before with respect to the Big Bang. The standard Big Bang model, as the Friedmann-Lemaître model came to be called, thus describes a universe which is not eternal in the past, but which came into being a finite time ago. Moreover, and this deserves underscoring, the origin that it posits is an absolute origin, ex nihilo. That's Latin for out of nothing. It is an absolute origin out of nothing. For not only all matter and energy, but space and time themselves come into being at the initial cosmological singularity. As Barrow and Tipler emphasize, at this singularity, space and time came into existence. Literally nothing existed before the singularity. So if the universe originated at such a singularity, we would truly have a creation ex nihilo. And so we can graphically represent space-time by means of this diagram. Here you have space being the horizontal dimension, the sort of disc-shaped surface at the top. Time is the vertical dimension. And as you go back in time, space shrinks down until finally it reaches the initial cosmological singularity at which space and time simply disappear. And on such a model, the universe originates ex nihilo, out of nothing, in the sense that at the initial cosmological singularity, it is true that there is no earlier space-time point. Or alternatively, it is false that something existed prior to the singularity. Now, such a conclusion is profoundly disturbing for anyone who ponders it seriously, for the obvious question cannot be suppressed. Why does the universe exist instead of just nothing? Sir Arthur Eddington contemplating the beginning of the universe, said that the expansion of the universe was so preposterous and incredible that I feel almost an indignation that anyone should believe in it, except myself. He finally felt forced to conclude, "The beginning seems to present insuperable difficulties unless we agree to look on it as, frankly, supernatural." Standard Big Bang cosmology thus presents a crisis for scientific naturalism, since in the words of the atheist philosopher Quentin Smith, it belongs analytically to the concept of the initial singularity that it is not the effect of prior physical events. The definition of a singularity entails that it is impossible to extend the space-time manifold beyond the singularity. This rules out the idea that the singularity is an effect of some prior natural process. Now, Smith recognizes that the question which then remains is whether the Big Bang might be plausibly regarded as the result of a supernatural cause. Otherwise, one must say that the universe simply sprang into being uncaused out of absolutely nothing. And thus, in the words of one astrophysical team, the problem of the origin involves a certain metaphysical aspect which may be either appealing or revolting. Revolted by the stark metaphysical alternatives presented by an absolute beginning of the universe, naturalists have naturally, or understandably, been eager to subvert the standard model and restore an eternal universe. Sir Fred Hoyle, for example, could countenance neither an uncaused nor a supernaturally caused origin of the universe. With respect to the singularity, he wrote, "This most peculiar situation is taken by many astronomers to represent the origin of the universe. The universe is supposed to have begun at this particular time. From where? The usual answer, surely an unsatisfactory one, is from nothing." But equally unsatisfactory in Hoyle's mind was the postulation of a supernatural cause. Noting that some people accept happily the universe's absolute beginning, Hoyle complained, "To many people, this thought process seems highly satisfactory, because a something outside physics can then be introduced at t equals zero. By a semantic maneuver, this word something is then replaced by God, except that the first letter becomes a capital G, God, in order to warn us that we must not carry the inquiry any further." Well, to Hoyle's credit, he did carry the inquiry further by helping to formulate the first competitor to the standard model. In 1948, Hoyle, together with Hermann Bondi and Thomas Gold, broached the steady-state model of the universe. Now, according to this theory, the universe is in a state of cosmic expansion, all right, but as the galaxies recede from one another, new matter comes into being in the realms of space that are vacated by the receding galaxies, so that over time, the condition of the universe remains unchanged. And so on the steady state theory, as the universe expands and the galaxies recede from each other, from one another, new matter comes into being ex nihilo, out of nothing, in the voids left by the receding galaxies, so that the universe remains steady over time. So the expansion of the universe in the steady state model can be compared to a rubber sheet with buttons glued to it. As the sheet is stretched and the buttons separate from one another, new buttons come into being in the voids created by the recession of the previously existing buttons. And thus, the condition of the sheet remains constant over time, and no beginning of the process needs to be posited. If you extrapolate the expansion of the universe back in time, the density of the universe never increases, because as the matter, or rather as the galaxies approach, the matter and energy simply vanish into nothingness as the galaxies coalesce. Now, the steady state theory never secured a single piece of experimental verification. Its appeal was purely metaphysical. The discovery of progressively more radio galaxies at ever greater distances also undermined the theory by showing that in the past the universe was significantly different than it is today, and that contradicted the notion of the universe being in a steady state. Instead, it became increasingly evident that the universe has an evolutionary history. But the decisive refutation of the steady state model came with two discoveries which constituted, in addition to the galactic red shift, the most significant evidence for the Big Bang theory, namely the cosmogonic nucleosynthesis of the light elements and the microwave background radiation. With respect to the first, although the heavy elements like carbon and iron and so forth were synthesized in the stellar furnaces, the interior of the stars, stellar nucleosynthesis could not manufacture the abundant light elements such as helium and deuterium. These could only have been created in the extreme conditions that were present in the first moment of the Big Bang. With regard to the second discovery, in 1965, a serendipitous discovery revealed the existence of a cosmic background radiation that was predicted in the 1940s by George Gamow on the basis of the Standard Model. And this is a background of radiation which is the same sort of radiation in your microwave oven at home if you have such an appliance. And this radiation, which is shifted into the microwave region of the spectrum, is composed of photons or light particles that were emitted during a very hot and very dense phase of the universe. And since no such phase ever existed in the steady state model, that theory could not explain the microwave background radiation. So in the minds of almost all cosmologists, the cosmic background radiation decisively discredited the steady state model. Now, the Standard Model was based on the assumptions of homogeneity and isotropy, that is to say that the universe is the same overall in all directions on large scales. But some cosmologists, particularly Soviet physicists, speculated that by denying homogeneity and isotropy, one might be able to craft an oscillating model of the universe. If the internal gravitational pull of the mass of the universe were able to overcome the force of the expansion, then the expansion could be reversed into a cosmic contraction, a sort of big crunch, the mirror image of the Big Bang. And if the universe were not homogeneous and isotropic, then the collapsing universe might not coalesce to a point, but the material contents of the universe might pass one another by. They might miss one another as the universe collapses, so that the universe would appear to bounce back to a new expansion after the contracting phase. And if this process could be repeated indefinitely, then you would avoid an absolute beginning of the universe. So on the oscillating theory of the universe is sort of like a spring which is expanding and contracting from all eternity and goes through an infinite number of cycles prior to today and into the future world without end. Now, such a theory is extraordinarily speculative, but again, there were metaphysical motivations for adopting this model. The prospects of the oscillating model were severely dimmed in 1970, however, by Roger Penrose and Stephen Hawking's formulation of the singularity theorems, which bear their names, the Hawking-Penrose singularity theorems. These theorems disclose that under very generalized conditions, an initial cosmological singularity is inevitable, even for inhomogeneous and non-isotropic universes. Reflecting on the impact of this discovery, Hawking notes that the Hawking-Penrose singularity theorems, and I quote, led to the abandonment of attempts, mainly by the Russians, to argue that there was a previous contracting phase and a non-singular bounce into expansion. Instead, he says, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Well, despite that the termini of a closed universe must be singularities and that no space-time trajectory can be extended through a singularity, the oscillating model exhibited a stubborn persistence. But then three further strikes were lodged against it. First, there are no known physics which would cause a collapsing universe to bounce back to a new expansion. If, in defiance of the Hawking-Penrose singularity theorems, the universe rebounds, this is predicated upon a physics which is completely unknown. Second, the observational evidence indicates that the mean mass density of the universe is insufficient to generate enough gravitational attraction to halt and reverse the expansion. Tests employing a variety of techniques for measuring the density of the universe and the deceleration of the expansion continued to point to a density below the critical value. Most recently, in January of 1998, astronomical teams from Princeton University, Yale University, the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and the Harvard Smithsonian Astrophysics Institute reported at the American Astronomical Society meeting that their various tests all show that the universe will expand forever. A spokesman for the Harvard Smithsonian team stated that they were now at least 95% certain that the density of matter is insufficient to halt the expansion of the universe, and this effectively rules out an oscillating universe. Since that time, even more recent discoveries have suggested that far from slowing down, the expansion of the universe is actually accelerating. Apparently, when the universe reaches a certain density, a kind of anti-gravity force kicks in, which actually serves to drive the expansion at an accelerating rate, which makes it all the more impossible for the universe to recontract. But thirdly, the thermodynamic properties of an oscillating model imply the very beginning of the universe that its proponents sought to avoid. In an oscillating model, entropy is conserved from cycle to cycle, and this has the effect of generating larger and longer oscillations with each successive cycle, so that the oscillating model with entropy increase would look like this. Whoops. As one traces the oscillations back in time, they get smaller and smaller and smaller until one finally reaches a first and smallest oscillation. The great Russian team of physicists, Zeldovich and Novikov, conclude the multi-cycle model has an infinite future, but only a finite past. In fact, the astronomer Joseph Silk has estimated, on the basis of current entropy levels, that the universe cannot have gone through more than 100 previous oscillations. Now, although these difficulties were well known, Proponents of the oscillating model tenaciously clung to it until a new alternative to the standard model emerged during the 1970s. Looking back, quantum cosmologist Christopher Isham of the Imperial College of Science and Technology in London muses, perhaps the best argument in favor of the thesis that the Big Bang supports theism is the obvious unease with which it is greeted by some atheist physicists. At times, this has led to scientific ideas such as continuous creation, that's another name for the steady state model, continuous creation, or an oscillating universe, being advanced with a tenacity which so exceeds their intrinsic worth that one can only suspect the operation of psychological forces lying very much deeper than the usual academic desire of a theorist to support his or her theory. The oscillating model drew its life from its avoidance of the absolute beginning of the universe. But once other models became available, claiming to offer the same benefit, the oscillating model sunk into oblivion under the weight of its own deficiencies. Well, it was realized that a physical description of the universe prior to the Planck time, that's 10 to the negative 43 second after the Big Bang singularity, a physical description of the universe prior to that Planck time would require the introduction of quantum physics, the physics of the subatomic realm, in addition to the general theory of relativity. Now, on the quantum level, so-called virtual particles are thought to arise due to fluctuations in the energy which is locked up in the vacuum. Particles which the Heisenberg indeterminacy principle allows to exist for a fleeting moment of time before dissolving back again into the vacuum. In 1973, Edward Tryon speculated whether the universe might not be a long-lived virtual particle whose total energy is zero, which was born out of the primordial vacuum. Now, this seemingly bizarre speculation gave rise to a new generation of cosmogonic theories, which we may call vacuum fluctuation models. Now, these models were closely related to an adjustment to the standard model known as inflation. In an attempt to explain, or explain away, depending on your viewpoint, the astonishing large-scale homogeneity and isotropy of the universe, certain theorists proposed that between 10 to the negative 35 and 10 to the negative 33 second after the Big Bang singularity, the universe underwent a phase of super rapid or inflationary expansion, an expansion which served to push the inhomogeneities out beyond our event horizon, that is, out beyond what we can see with our measuring instruments. Prior to the inflationary era, the universe was merely empty space or a vacuum. And the material universe was born when the vacuum energy was converted into matter by a quantum mechanical phase transition. Now, in most inflationary models, as one extrapolates backward in time beyond the Planck time, the universe continues to shrink down to the initial singularity. But in vacuum fluctuation models, it is hypothesized that prior to the inflationary era, the universe as a whole was not expanding. The universe as a whole is a primordial vacuum which exists eternally in a steady state. And throughout this vacuum, subatomic fluctuations in the energy constantly occur, by means of which matter is created and many, many universes are born. So on the vacuum fluctuation model within the womb of this wider mother universe, which is just an empty vacuum, fluctuations occur which grow into expanding mini universes. And our universe is simply one of these. Our expanding universe is but one of an indefinite number of mini universes conceived within the womb of this greater mother universe. And thus the beginning of our universe does not represent an absolute beginning. It's merely a change in the eternal, uncaused universe as a whole. Now, although these vacuum fluctuation models are still bandied about in the popular press, you read about this all the time. In fact, these models did not outlive the decade of the 1980s. Not only were there theoretical problems with the production mechanisms of matter, but these models also faced a deep internal incoherence. For according to such models, it is impossible to specify precisely where and when fluctuations would occur in the primordial vacuum, which will then grow into a universe. In fact, within any finite interval of time, there is a positive probability of such a fluctuation occurring at any point in space, at any point in the vacuum. And thus, given infinite past time, universes will eventually be spawned at every point in the primordial vacuum. And as they expand, they will begin to collide with one another and coalesce into one infinitely old universe filling all of the vacuum space. So given infinite past time, we should by now be observing an infinitely old universe filling all of the vacuum space, rather than our relatively young universe. Now, one theorist tried to avoid this problem by stipulating that the fluctuations in the primordial vacuum occur only infinitely far apart, so that each mini universe has an infinite amount of room in which to expand. Now, not only is this scenario unacceptably ad hoc or contrived, that is to say, there's absolutely no reason why the fluctuation should occur only infinitely far apart in the vacuum, but even more fundamentally, it does not even solve the problem. For given infinite past time, each of the infinite regions of the vacuum will have spawned an open universe, which by now will have entirely filled that region, with the result that all of the individual mini universes would have coalesced into one infinite universe filling all of the vacuum space. Christopher Isham has called this problem, and I quote, fairly lethal, end quote, to vacuum fluctuation models, and he says that therefore they have not found wide acceptance. About the only way to avoid this problem would be to postulate an expansion of the primordial vacuum itself. But then you're right back to the absolute origin implied by the standard model. You've just pushed the question back a notch. According to Isham, these models were therefore jettisoned 20 years ago, and nothing much has been done with them since. Now, inflation also forms the context for the next alternative we shall consider, the chaotic inflationary model. Inflationary theory has been criticized as unduly metaphysical, but it has also been crippled by various physical problems, such as getting inflation to transition smoothly to the current expansion. And so we've seen the old inflationary theory and the new inflationary theory, both of which are now dead. And one of the most fertile of the inflation theorists has been the Russian cosmologist Andrei Linde, who currently champions his chaotic inflationary model. According to the cosmologist Robert Brandenburger of Brown University, Linda's chaotic inflation scenario is the only viable inflationary model in the sense that it is not plagued by internal inconsistencies as old inflation and new inflation are. Now, in Linda's model, inflation never ends. Rather, each inflating domain of the universe, when it reaches a certain volume, gives rise, via inflation, to another domain, and so on, ad infinitum. So, on the chaotic inflationary model, the expansion of the universe is not like a simple balloon. It's sort of like a Mickey Mouse balloon, which as you blow it up, it sprouts ears, which then also inflate. But in this case, those also then sprout ears, which further inflate. And so it goes on and on without end, producing these various bubble universes. And so Linda's model has an infinite future. But Linda is troubled at the prospect of an absolute beginning of the universe. He writes, "The most difficult aspect of this problem is not the existence of the singularity itself, but the question of what was before the singularity. This problem lies somewhere at the boundary between physics and metaphysics." And Linda therefore proposes that chaotic inflation is not only endless, but it is also beginningless. Every domain in the universe is the product of inflation in another domain, so that the singularity is averted, and with it as well, that troubling metaphysical question of what came before, or more accurately, I think, what caused the singularity. In 1994, however, Arvind Bord and Alexander Vilenkin showed that a universe inflating eternally toward the future cannot be what they call geodesically complete in the past. That is to say, there must have existed some point in the indefinite past an initial singularity. This is what they write. "A model in which the inflationary phase has no end naturally leads to this question. Can this model also be extended to the infinite past, avoiding in this way the problem of the initial singularity?" They answer, "This is in fact not possible in future eternal inflationary spacetimes, as long as they obey some reasonable physical conditions. Such models must necessarily possess initial singularities." They conclude, "The fact that inflationary spacetimes are past incomplete forces one to address the question of what, if anything, came before." And in his response to their article, Linda agrees with the conclusion of Bord and Vilenkin. He admits, "Now, there must have been a Big Bang singularity at some point in the past." Now, at the close of their analysis of Linda's chaotic inflationary model, Bord and Vilenkin say, with respect to Linda's metaphysical question, what came before the singularity, that the most promising way to deal with this problem is probably to treat the universe quantum mechanically and describe it by a wave function rather than by a classical spacetime. Now, they thereby allude to the next class of models attempting to avoid the initial cosmological singularity, namely quantum gravity models. Vilenkin, and more famously James Hartle and Stephen Hawking, have proposed models of the universe which Vilenkin candidly calls exercises in metaphysical cosmology. In his best-selling popularization of his theory, Hawking even reveals an explicitly theological orientation. Hawking concedes that on the Standard Model, one could legitimately identify the Big Bang singularity at the instant at which God created the universe. Indeed, Hawking thinks that a number of attempts to avoid the Big Bang were probably motivated by the feeling that a beginning of time smacks of divine intervention. And he sees his own model as preferable to the Standard Model because there would be no edge of space-time at which one would, quote, have to appeal to God or some new law, end quote. And as we'll see, Hawking is not at all reluctant to draw theological conclusions on the basis of his model. Both the Hartle-Hawking and the Vilenkin models eliminate the initial singularity by transforming the conical or cone-shaped hypersurface of classical spacetime into a smooth, curved hypersurface having no edge. Notice that rather than going back to a point, space shrinks down to a kind of southern hemisphere. It's rounded off, rather like the South Pole, so that you don't reach a point or a boundary or an edge to space-time. Rather, just as when you reach the South Pole and continue, you just start going north again. You don't fall off the edge of the Earth. There is no edge at the South Pole, similarly on the Hartle-Hawking model. Now, this rounding off of space-time at its beginning is accomplished by the introduction of imaginary numbers for the time variable in Einstein's gravitational equations, and this effectively eliminates the singularity. Imaginary numbers are numbers which are multiples of the square root of negative 1, and by putting imaginary numbers into his equations, Hawking can round off the initial cosmological singularity in his model. Now, Hawking sees profound theological implications in his theory. This is what he says. The idea that space and time may form a closed surface without a boundary has profound implications for the role of God in the affairs of the universe. So long as the universe had a beginning, we could suppose it had a creator. But if the universe is really completely self-contained, having no boundary or edge, it would have neither beginning nor end. What place, then, for a creator? Now, Hawking does not deny the existence of God, but he does think that his model eliminates the need for a creator. Now, what I propose to do at this time is to take a break during which the videotape can be changed, and then after our break, we'll come back and assess the credibility of Hawking's theological claim as well as his claim to have avoided the beginning of the universe. So let's take a 10-minute break at this time for a stretch and to change the videotape. We left off by looking at Hawking's claim that while not eliminating the existence of God as such, he does believe that his model has eliminated the need for a creator of the universe. The key to assessing this theological claim is the metaphysical interpretation of quantum gravity models. By postulating a finite, even if imaginary, time on a closed geometrical surface rather than an infinite time on an open surface, such models actually seem to support rather than undercut the idea that time had a beginning. Such theories, if successful, enable us to model the origin of the universe without an initial singularity involving infinite density, infinite temperature, infinite pressure, and so on. As John Barrow of Sussex University points out, this type of quantum universe has not always existed. It comes into being, just as the classical cosmologies could, but it does not start at a Big Bang where physical quantities are infinite. Barrow points out that such models are often described as giving a picture of creation out of nothing, the only caveat being that in this case, there is no definite point of creation. Hartle and Hawking themselves construe their model as giving, quote, the amplitude or the probability for the universe to appear from nothing, end quote. And Hawking has asserted that according to the model, the universe, and again I quote, would be quite literally created out of nothing, not just out of the vacuum, but out of absolutely nothing at all, because there is nothing outside the universe, end quote. Similarly, Vilenkin claims that his model describes the creation of the universe from literally nothing. Taken at face value, then, these statements entail the beginning of the universe. And therefore, I think Hawking must include himself when he says, today, virtually everybody believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Hawking's statement, then, that I quoted earlier concerning the theological implications of his model must therefore be understood to mean that on such models, there are no beginning or ending points. There are no beginning or ending points. But having a beginning does not entail having a beginning point. Even on the standard model, theorists sometimes cut out the initial singular point without thinking that therefore space-time no longer begins to exist and that the problem of the origin of the universe has thereby been resolved. Time begins to exist just in case for any temporal finite interval there are only a finite number of equal temporal intervals earlier than it. Let me repeat that definition again. Time begins to exist if and only if for any finite temporal interval that you pick there are only a finite number of equal temporal intervals earlier than it. And that definition is fulfilled for quantum gravity models of the universe as well as for the standard models. So in order for time to have a beginning, it doesn't need to have a beginning point. Hawking is just philosophically mistaken on that definition. Nor should we think that by giving the amplitude for the universe to appear from nothing, quantum cosmologists have eliminated the need for a creator, because that probability is conditional upon several choices which only the creator could make, such as selecting the wave function of the universe. And in any case, it's dubiously applied to absolute nothingness. There's really little meaning in talking about a probability of absolute nothingness giving rise to any sort of effect. Now, perhaps it will be said that such an interpretation of quantum gravity models fails to take seriously the notion of imaginary time. Introducing imaginary numbers, which you remember are multiples of the square root of negative 1, for the time variable in Einstein's equation, has the peculiar effect of making the time dimension indistinguishable from space. But in that case, the imaginary time regime prior to the Planck time is not really a space-time at all, but rather it is a Euclidean four-dimensional space. Construed realistically, such a four-dimensional space would be evacuated of all temporal becoming. It would simply exist timelessly. It's not a space-time, it's a four-dimensional space. And thus, Vilenkin characterizes this regime as a state in which all our basic notions of space, time, energy, entropy, etc., lose their meaning. Hawking describes it as completely self-contained and not affected by anything outside itself. It would be neither created nor destroyed. It would just be. And I take that as an expression of its timeless existence. It's just a four-dimensional space. It would just be. Well, the question which arises for this construal of the model is whether such a construal is meant to be taken realistically or merely instrumentally. And on this score, there can be little doubt that the use of imaginary quantities for time is a mere mathematical device without ontological significance. Barrow observes, physicists have often carried out this change time into space procedure as a useful trick for doing certain problems in ordinary quantum mechanics, although they did not imagine that time was really like space. At the end of the calculation, they just swap back into the usual interpretation of there being one dimension of time and three dimensions of space. In his model, Hawking simply declines to reconvert to real numbers at the end of the calculation. If you do, then the singularity reappears. Hawking admits, and I quote, "Only if we could picture the universe in terms of imaginary time would there be no singularities. When one goes back to the real time in which we live, however, there would still appear to be singularities." End quote. So Hawking's model is thus merely a way of re-describing a universe with a singular beginning point in such a way that that singularity is transformed away. But such a re-description is not realist in character. It's just a mathematical device. It's just a way of re-describing a universe with a singular beginning in such a way that the singularity doesn't appear in the re-description. Remarkably, Hawking has himself stated explicitly that he interprets the Hartle-Hawking model non-realistically. He confesses, quote, "I'm a positivist. I don't demand that a theory correspond to reality because I don't know what it is," end quote. Still more extreme, quote, "I take the positivist view that a physical theory is just a mathematical model and that it is meaningless to ask whether it corresponds to reality," end quote. In assessing the worth of a theory, quote, "All I'm concerned with is that the theory should predict the results of measurements," end quote. The clearest example of Hawking's instrumentalism is his combination of an electron quantum tunneling in Euclidean space, with time being imaginary, and an electron-positron pair accelerating away from each other in normal Minkowski spacetime. This analysis is directly analogous to the Hartle-Hawking cosmological model, and yet no one would construe particle pair creation as literally the result of an electron transitioning out of a timelessly existing four-dimensional space into our classical spacetime. It's just an alternative mathematical description employing imaginary numbers rather than real numbers. Significantly, the use of imaginary numbers for time is an inherent feature of all quantum gravity models. This precludes their being understood realistically as accounts of the origin of the space-time universe in a timelessly existing four-space. Rather, they are just ways of modeling the real beginning of the universe ex nihilo in such a way as to not involve a singularity in the model. But what brought the universe into being remains unexplained on such accounts. Now, at this point, I find to my chagrin that I have brought an old copy of this lecture and therefore do not have the material on the most recent wrinkle in cosmological speculation, which is string theory. So let me, with some disability, attempt to do this from memory. Fortunately, I have the visual for this. We now come to the extreme edge of cosmological speculation. Is it in the one that you've got? Then I could look at that. Greatly help me. Okay, here we go. Well, we're going to talk about it. Okay, we come to the extreme edge of cosmological speculation, string cosmology. Now, these models are based on an alternative to the standard quark model of elementary particle physics. So-called string theory, or M theory, as it's often called, conceives the fundamental building blocks of matter to be not particles, like quarks, but tiny vibrating strings of energy. Now, string theory is so complicated and so embryonic in its development that all of its equations have not even been stated yet, much less solved. But that hasn't deterred some cosmologists from trying to craft cosmological models based on concepts of string theory to try to avert the beginning of the universe predicted by the standard Big Bang cosmology. In fact, you may have seen in the recent May issue of the Scientific American magazine, the cover story is on did the universe have a beginning, claiming that the most recent discoveries in string theory have avoided the beginning of the universe. So this is very popular in the popular press. And the most celebrated of these scenarios in the popular press has been the so-called ekpyrotic scenario championed by Paul Steinhardt of Princeton University. Now again, this ekpyrotic model has already been subjected to criticism and gone through a number of revisions. And in the most recent revision, the cyclic ekpyrotic model, we are asked to envision two three-dimensional membranes, or brains for short, existing in a five-dimensional space-time. And one of these brains, this one here, is supposed to be our universe. These two brains are in an eternal cycle in which they approach each other, collide, and then bounce back again from each other, and then reapproach, spank together, and retreat once again. And it's the collision of each brain with the other brain that causes the expansion in our universe to occur. With each collision, the expansion is renewed. And thus, even though our three-dimensional universe is expanding, nevertheless, it never had a beginning. Now, apart from its wholly speculative nature, the ekpyrotic scenario is plagued with scientific problems. For example, the Horava-Witten version of string theory on which the scenario is based requires that the brain on which we live have a positive tension. But in the ekpyrotic scenario, it has a negative tension in contradiction to the theory, and attempts to rectify this so far have been unsuccessful. Secondly, the model requires an extraordinary amount of ad hoc fine tuning. For example, these two brains have to be so perfectly aligned with one another that even at a distance of 10 to the 30th power greater than the space between them, they cannot deviate from being parallel by more than 10 to the negative 60th power. So at distances 10 to the 30 times the distance between them, they cannot deviate from absolute parallel by more than 10 to the negative 60th power. And there's no explanation at all in the theory for this extraordinary setup, this incredible fine-tuning. Thirdly, the collapsing and retreating brains are the equivalent of a four-dimensional universe which goes through an eternal cycle of contractions and expansions. In other words, the cyclic ekpyrotic model is just our old friend, the oscillating model, writ large in five dimensions. And as such, it faces exactly the same problem as the original oscillating model. Namely, there is no way for the universe to pass through a singularity at the end of each cycle and to begin a new cycle. And there is no physics to cause a non-singular bounce. Finally, even if the brains could bounce back to a new expansion, there is no means of the physical information in one cycle being carried through to the next cycle, so that the ekpyrotic scenario has been unable to deliver on its promises to explain the large-scale structure of the observable universe. Now, these are just some of the problems afflicting the model. It's no wonder that André Linde has recently complained that while the cyclic ekpyrotic scenario is very popular among journalists, it has remained rather unpopular among scientists. But let all that pass. Perhaps these problems can somehow be resolved with future work. The more important point remains that it turns out that, like the chaotic inflationary model, the cyclic ekpyrotic scenario cannot be eternal in the past. In September of 2001, Bord and Vilenkin, in cooperation with Alan Guth, the father of inflationary cosmology, were able to generalize their earlier results on inflationary models in such a way as to extend these conclusions to other models. Specifically, they note, our argument can be straightforwardly extended to cosmology in higher dimensions, specifically brain cosmology. According to Vilenkin, it follows from our theorem that the cyclic universe is past incomplete, that is to say, the need for an initial singularity has not been eliminated, and therefore the universe cannot be past eternal. Well, with the successive failure of alternative cosmogonic theories to avoid the absolute beginning of the universe predicted by the standard model, that prediction has been corroborated. This beginning of the universe, of space and time themselves, reveals the contingency of the universe. The universe is evidently not necessarily existent, as Hume suggested, since it is not eternal, and therefore its existence does cry out for explanation. It is no longer sufficient to dismiss this problem with a shrug and a slogan, the universe is just there, and that's all. Now, of course, in view of the metaphysical issues raised by the prospect of the beginning of the universe, we may be confident that the quest to avert such a beginning will continue unabated. And I want to say emphatically that such efforts are to be encouraged, and we have no reason to think that such attempts at falsification will result in anything other than further corroboration of the prediction of a beginning. And in the meantime, the beginning cannot just be wished away. Given its origin ex nihilo, the demand why the universe exists, rather than nothing, presses insistently upon us. Okay, I will return this. So with each successive failure of alternative cosmogonic theories, the standard model has been corroborated. It can be confidently said, I think, that no cosmogonic model has been repeatedly verified in its predictions or is corroborated by attempts at its falsification, in addition to being as concordant with empirical discoveries and as philosophically coherent as the standard model. Reflecting upon the current situation, P.C.W. Davies muses, what caused the Big Bang? One might consider some supernatural force, some agency beyond space and time as being responsible for the Big Bang, or one might prefer to regard the Big Bang as an event without a cause. It seems to me that we don't have too much choice either. Something outside the physical world or an event without a cause. Now, I'm going to again depart somewhat from the paper I think that you have in the interests of time and talk about the supernaturalist alternative. If we go the route of postulating some causal agency beyond space and time as being responsible for the origin of the universe, then naturalism is no longer plausible. For analysis of what properties must be possessed by such an ultra-mundane cause enables us to recover a striking number of the traditional divine attributes so that such a cause is plausibly to be called God. For as the cause of space and time, this entity must transcend space and time, and therefore must exist atemporally and non-spatially, at least sans the universe. This transcendent cause must therefore be changeless and immaterial, since timelessness entails changelessness, and changelessness implies immateriality. Such a cause must be beginningless and uncaused, at least in the sense of lacking any antecedent causal conditions. Occam's razor will shave away further causes, since we should not multiply causes beyond necessity. This entity must be unimaginably powerful, if not omnipotent, since it created the universe out of nothing. And it's hard to imagine a more maximal power than the ability to create from nothing. Finally, such a transcendent cause is plausibly personal. I think this is already implied by its timelessness and immateriality, since the only entities that we know of that could possess such properties as timelessness and immateriality are either minds or abstract objects, like numbers. But abstract objects do not stand in causal relations. And therefore, it follows that the cause of the universe must be a personal, unembodied mind. But I think this conclusion is also implied by the origin of a temporal effect from a timeless cause. If the cause of the universe were an impersonal set of necessary and sufficient conditions, then it could not exist without its effect. Otherwise, the conditions would not be truly sufficient. Once the sufficient conditions are given, the effect must be given as well. Let me give an illustration. Suppose that the cause of water's freezing is the temperature being below 0 degrees centigrade. Well, if the temperature were below 0 degrees centigrade from eternity past, then any water that was around would be frozen from eternity. It would be impossible for the water to just begin to freeze a finite time ago. So if the sufficient conditions are eternally present, then the effect should be eternally present as well. But in this case, how do you get then a temporal effect with a beginning like the universe from a cause which is eternal? Well, it seems to me that the only way for the cause to be timeless and eternal and changeless, but for its effect to originate de novo, a finite time ago, is for the cause to be a personal agent endowed with freedom of the will, who freely chooses to create a new effect in time without any antecedent determining conditions. For example, a man sitting from eternity could freely will to stand up, and thus you would have a temporal effect arise from an eternal cause. Philosophers call this kind of causation agent causation, and it implies that the cause of the universe is not simply a transcendent, immaterial, timeless, changeless being, but a personal agent. And thus we are brought not merely to a transcendent cause of the universe, but to its personal creator. And this, as Thomas Aquinas laconically remarked, is what everybody means by God. I think that at that point, I am going to skip to the end of the talk and bring it to a close. We can summarize the argument as follows. Premise one. Whatever exists has a reason for its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external ground. Two, whatever begins to exist is not necessary in its existence. Three, if the universe has an external ground of its existence, then there exists a personal creator of the universe who, sans the universe, is timeless, spaceless, beginningless, changeless, necessary, uncaused, and enormously powerful. Four, the universe began to exist. Five, therefore the universe is not necessary in its existence. That follows from two and four. Whatever begins to exist is not necessary in its existence. The universe began to exist. Therefore, five, the universe is not necessary in its existence. Six, therefore, the universe has an external ground of its existence. That follows from 1 and 5. Whatever exists has a reason for its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external ground. The universe is not necessary in its existence. Therefore, the universe has an external ground of its existence. 7. Therefore, there exists a personal creator of the universe who, sans the universe, is timeless, spaceless, beginningless, changeless, necessary, uncaused, and enormously powerful. And that follows from 3 and 6 and gives us, I think, a conclusion that suggests that God exists. All right, that completes what I wanted to share. I'll turn the floor back over to Richard now. Thank you.
It's a shame that the postmodern touchy-feely zeitgeist has got hold of Bill. I'm sorry that was a little bit content light, but you know, hopefully the standard will go up as the week goes on. That's called irony for any other Americans not laughing. Now, we're going to have an opportunity to formulate some questions, and I suggest, for two reasons, we're not going to do that immediately now, and the two reasons are this. Those with English as a first language are going to obviously be the most immediately advantaged to ask their questions, and also those of a certain temperament are going to be very forward in doing that. So what we're going to do is we're going to split into groups of either 4 or 5 staying in this room, and we will introduce ourselves to each other in those groups very briefly. Don't go on, just say where you're from and what your interest is and the whole apologetic thing, and then begin to discuss what questions you would like to put to Bill. One first category that suggests itself is questions of clarification. There might be some remote possibility that you want some clarity on just some of the issues. Okay. Another obvious area for questioning is the applicability of this whole area of Big Bang cosmology to the apologetic task. how do we use this? Certainly, obviously, it's undergirding our confidence, but how might we use this in our own apologetics? And then, obviously, the area you're most interested in as apologists is the opportunity to disagree and to debate with Bill. Okay? So those, think of other areas, but I would suggest that questions of clarification and relevance and obviously disagreement and discussion. So we'll do that for about 15 to 20 minutes, okay, in those groups, discussing the issues. And then if you decide amongst you, you think, well, we've covered some great points here, but that question must be asked. That really is an important question. And then we'll try and get those questions, okay? So if we could just break around the room into groups of four, at the most five, introduce yourselves quickly, and then formulate some questions for Bill.
Okay, Bill, over to you. All right, we're going to have our question time or discussion time now.
Should I just explain the shape of it?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, Bill. Just to say, again, we've decided with regard to those who are here for the first time, that we'll keep you in for the whole of this. And then the suggestion is that you pick up your bag lunch and together, all the people who are here for the first time with Lars and Stefan and myself, we have some lunch together and we just make some introductions that way. So if you're in the introductory stream, even though you're all together here, what I suggest is immediately at a quarter past, grab a bag lunch and then come and somewhere down here, and then we'll sit together and make the introduction. So without wasting any more of your time, Bill.
Okay. All right. Did you want to handle the questions by starting with comprehension-type questions or just a free-for-all? Okay, let's start then with the clarification questions before we get into the more substantive and application type questions. Was there any clarification question? Yes. All right. The question was to explain point two on the outline a little bit more. All right. Whatever begins to exist is not necessary in its existence. Philosophers have analyzed the concept of what it means to be a necessary being. You remember Leibniz's question with which we began this talk, why is there something rather than nothing? And Leibniz answered this by saying there must be a necessary being, a being whose non-existence is impossible, a being which must exist, a being which cannot not exist. And philosophers analyzing the concept of necessary existence have determined that such a necessarily existent being would have to be eternal, uncaused, incorruptible, and indestructible. And the reasons for that is, obviously, that if it lacked any of those properties, its existence would not be necessary. It could fail to exist. If it was not eternal, then that means it had a beginning or an end of its existence, and thus it doesn't have to exist. Its non-existence is possible. If it's caused, then its cause could fail to produce it, and so it would not be necessary in its being. If it's corruptible or destructible, again, it could fall into non-existence and therefore would fail to be necessary. So the idea here is that in order to be a necessary being, a being must be an eternal being. It must always exist. And it was this presumed eternality of the universe that allowed philosophers like Hume and Russell to suggest that the material universe itself may be the necessarily existent being sought by Leibniz. And therefore, there was no need to postulate anything beyond the universe in order to answer the question, why is there something rather than nothing? The universe is eternal, uncaused, incorruptible, and indestructible. So premise two just focuses on one of those four properties of a necessary being. This is an excellent question, and the subject of creation or the beginning of the universe raises in a way that no other question does, I think, the poignant issue of God's relationship to time. And I think it does make sense to talk about God existing in time alone without the universe. We can imagine, for example, a mental sequence of events in God's mind. Say God is counting. Maybe he counts down to creation. 3, 2, 1, let there be light. Well, in that case, there would be a series of mental events that would set up a sequence of before and after. So I certainly think that time is something that can exist in the absence of space, because time is not only a feature of the external physical world, it's a feature of the interior realm of the mind as well, as mental events occur in a stream of consciousness. So the question of whether or not there is time prior to creation is a question of whether or not God is undergoing a sequence of these sorts of mental events. And I would argue, for different reasons than the physical reasons I talked about today, that no, he does not. That God, without the universe, is absolutely changeless and does not experience a sequence of mental events. And that therefore, it's simplest to simply think of the moment of the Big Bang as the moment of creation and the beginning of time. So while I think it makes sense to talk about time without creation, I don't see any reason to postulate such a thing. Do you understand what I'm saying? That a view can make sense without saying the view is true. I think it's a coherent view, but I don't think it's true. Is that distinction clear? So the question would be, does God experience a series of mental events prior to creation? And I don't see any reason to think that he does. Yes. Yes. Yes, I think that's right. This is a different version of the cosmological argument than the version I've talked about today. The version of the cosmological argument that you just stated is actually the one defended by Leibniz himself. Leibniz, in answer to the question, why is there something rather than nothing, said that this question is not answered by postulating an eternal universe in the past, because we could still ask, why does an eternal universe exist rather than nothing? So merely postulating earlier states of the universe doesn't really answer the question, why does the universe exist? And so for Leibniz, the past beginning of the universe was simply irrelevant to his argument for the existence of God. And I think that the Leibnizian argument is a good one. I have defended that in print as well. I would formulate it in the following way. Premise one, anything that exists has a reason for its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external cause. Premise two, if the universe has a reason for its existence, that reason is God. Premise three, the universe exists. And from those three premises, it follows that the universe has a reason for its existence, and that that reason is God. And that doesn't appeal to the beginning of the universe at all. Now, the difficulty with the Leibnizian argument would be, somebody might say, but maybe the reason for the existence of the universe is that it exists by a necessity of its own nature. Maybe it's necessary in its being. And I think that here the argument that I gave can help to supplement or complement the Leibnizian argument by showing that the universe is not necessary in its existence, and that therefore it cries out for an explanation. So I think both of these arguments are good arguments for God, and I think the argument I gave can be both an independent argument as well as a supplement to the Leibnizian argument. Yes. 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 All right. Well, let's talk about that a little bit more. I actually gave two different arguments for the personhood of the first cause. The first one was based on the timelessness and immateriality of the first cause. As far as I know, the only beings, the only entities that philosophers or anybody has identified that can exist timelessly and immaterially would either be a mind, and by a mind I mean a self-consciousness, not a brain. Now, that's a physical organ that sits in your cranium. A mind is a self, I. A mind can be immaterial, and I think it could be timeless if it doesn't change. Or the other thing would be abstract objects. These would be things like numbers, properties, sets, mathematical entities. And some philosophers think there are such things as abstract objects that could exist timelessly and immaterial. But I can't think of anything else, nor has anybody else, as far as I know, thought of anything else that can have the properties of timelessness and immateriality than minds or abstract objects. But abstract objects, it's universally agreed, don't stand in causal relations. The number seven has no effect on anything. Abstract objects are causally impotent. And yet we've seen this being is the cause of the origin of the universe. So it logically implies, therefore, it must be an immaterial, unembodied mind. So the logic is very clear. P or Q, not Q, therefore P. So that does seem to me to be a good argument. Now, the other argument was the argument based upon how you get a temporal effect with a beginning from a cause that is eternal and timeless. And the dilemma there is that if the cause is truly sufficient for its effect, then the effect should be co-eternal with the cause. Otherwise, it's not sufficient. It's not truly sufficient. So how do you get a cause that is truly sufficient, that is eternal, and yet its effect only begins a finite number of years ago? And the only answer I can think of to that is free will. Now, if somebody can think of another alternative, that's great. I would invite them to suggest it, and then we'll consider it. But I've never had anybody in the literature respond to this argument by suggesting anything else other than freedom of the will that could do such a thing. Interestingly enough, this argument is an ancient Islamic argument. This version of the cosmological argument was highly developed by medieval Islamic thinkers. And they called this the principle of determination. Then when you have two equal possibilities and one of them results, there must be some free determinator who chooses one of them rather than the other. And I think that these Islamic theologians were on the mark here in saying that this points to the personhood of the cause of the universe. So those would be two reasons for the personhood of the cause. And that's absolutely critical for this having theological significance, isn't it? Is you need to have the personhood of this entity if it's to have significant theological implications. Yes? Yeah. Yeah, I've presented this in lots of different environments. In fact, the paper that I read to you today really was not a paper for popular consumption. This is a paper that has been read at professional conferences in philosophy and with other scientists. And the response has been very, very good. For example, I spoke at an astronomy conference in Johannesburg in South Africa that brought together some of the top physicists in the world dealing with galaxy formation and the history of the universe. And the organizer of the conference, David Block, is a Christian, And he asked me to speak in the evening at this astronomy conference of all these professional astronomers. And during the conference, there was one Italian physicist in particular who was aware that I was on the program. And he was pretty upset about this. And he came to me just before I spoke, and he said, "I'm sitting in the back row." He says, "I'm giving you 3 minutes. And if I get any BS from you," he says, "I'm out the door in 3 minutes." And I said, "All right." I said, "That's fine. I said, I think that you'll find this all right." Well, I gave the talk. Afterwards, he came down to the front. And I said, "You're still here." And he said, "Yes." He said, "I thought that was outstanding. That was just excellent." And this man was a deeply non-Christian, hostile guy. So that, to me, was just a real victory in terms of the response of a professional astronomer to this material. And it's been used as well, I think, by philosophers. I spoke last summer at the University of Milan in Italy at a conference that was organized by the University of Milan and two Austrian universities, a conference called Analytic Philosophy Without Naturalism. This was the first glimmerings that I've seen in Europe of philosophers who are sick of naturalism and want to try to do good analytic philosophy without the presupposition of naturalism. And in order to hold this conference, they invited a number of Christian philosophers from the United States and England to come to Italy to model for them what non-naturalistic philosophy looks like. And I read this paper there, and it's going to be published very soon in the proceedings that came out of that conference for philosophers in Italy. And so I'm very encouraged by the kind of impact this can have in the professional, philosophical, and scientific realm. But on a popular level, I speak on lots of university campuses, and I've actually seen people come to Christ through this argument, even though it says nothing about Christ at all. It doesn't even mention Jesus. But for some people, it just removed the barrier to belief in God so that they've been ready to give their lives to Christ because they've heard some good evidence that there really is a creator of the universe, and they were ready to make a commitment. I remember one Oriental student in Canada who, after the classroom lecture, came up to me and he says, "I've been an atheist for a long time now, and my brother is an atheist." He said, "I've never heard anything like this." He said, "I now believe that God exists. I can hardly wait to go and talk to my brother about this." So that was just exciting again to see the Lord use this in practical ways. So it's material that you can share unapologetically and unabashedly on the highest levels, but also on a popular level for the layman or the student as well. Yes, Roger.
Yes, to follow on from that question, the point you just mentioned, is that most people don't read Stephen Hawking's books. They buy them and put them on the shelf and look.
Right.
And at the popular level, the understanding of time and philosophy is at a terrible all-time low for most countries. Mm-hmm. So how do we seed the ideas into society at the most simplest level that get them to the point where people
there's
a lot of reason why there must be God. So it's more a question of strategy,
yes,
of planting ideas, and how you take these ideas and use the tricks that this secular world is using very well. To take Hawking's book, he says, in that Scientist in America article, we don't need to believe there is
a right. Okay, a question of strategy. I feel strongly about this because I think we want to be cultural forces for change. And I think the very first thing that we as Christians need to do is we need to educate the church. We need to educate Christian laymen about this. And I think one of the ways this can be done is through courses offered in the church. I teach every Sunday an adult Sunday school class at our Baptist church in Atlanta. And I'm teaching this very kind of thing right now to the lay people in my Sunday school class. And they get so excited about it. Once you put it on a level that they can understand, they want to understand this. People are hungry for this material. They want to get beyond just simpering devotional thoughts and emotionally fuzzy feelings, and really get some good, hard information that they can share with their neighbor or their coworker. And so I would encourage us, all of us, to go back to our home churches and to initiate, I don't know, apologetic clubs or Sunday school classes or some kind of adult education courses in our churches where we begin to educate Christians in this kind of material, and then we can send them out into the world. Now, some good resources for doing this, I would say, would be Lee Strobel's books, Case for Christ, Case for Faith, and his new book, Case for a Creator. Lee is a journalist, and he writes on a level that is very engaging for lay people. I have been shocked at how popular Lee Strobel's books are, and yet they are substantive. I've read them, and I've been impressed. I thought, this is not fluffy material. This is substantive stuff, but it's presented by a journalist in a lively, dynamic way that lay people can really grab. So I would take my layman through some of Lee Strobel's books as an introduction. Now, once you begin to understand this material, then we as Christians, I think, need to begin to speak out in the public square more, writing letters to the editor. I don't know if they have this in your country. In my country, we have something called talk radio, where anybody can call the radio station and be on the talk show. And we need Christians who can articulate well what we believe and not just sort of foam at the mouth and pound the Bible and quote the Bible at people. We need Christians who can articulate what they believe to be involved in the public square. So those would be a couple of just very rudimentary and initial ways in which we can get involved. But I think the first and foremost thing we need to do is to educate our laity. Yes? Yeah. Well, often you can kind of put in a personal teaser at the end. Say, if you gave a talk like this, you could raise the question, has this creator of the universe revealed himself in some way to us that we can know him more fully, or has he remained aloof and distant from the world that he's made? And then sometimes I'll simply read the prologue to the Gospel of John, where it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory as of the only begotten of the Father. Something like that. You can form a transition, you know, to the God of the Bible, or Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so it's not hard to make a transition, I think, from this to biblical material. Very often what I'll do is I'll present this argument just as a part of a broader case for Christian theism. I give a talk very frequently called Five Reasons God Exists and Three Reasons It Makes a Difference. And this is the first of the arguments. Then after that is the design argument, then the moral argument, then the argument from the resurrection of Jesus. You see, you're getting more Christian. And then finally, an argument based on personal experience. And that's very personal. And I'll usually give my testimony about how I was once a non-Christian and I came to know Christ as a secondary school student when someone shared the gospel with me. So this will just be the first step, you know, in introducing someone to the idea of God. But by the end of the talk, you're talking on a very personal level. So this is really just part of a cumulative case for Christian theism. Yes? Yeah. Yes. Well, I wouldn't say you can't do it. I mean, for some people, the evidence for the resurrection might be sufficient to convince them that there is a God who has revealed himself in Christ. And if so, go for it, I would say. But for some people, their presuppositions are so deeply naturalistic that the evidence for the resurrection will just bounce like water off a stone, because a resurrection is impossible because there is no God. It's a matter of presuppositions. For example, I don't know if you heard the story about the man who thought he was dead. This guy believed that he was dead, even though he was a living human being. And his poor wife finally convinced him to go to a psychologist, who tried in vain to convince the man that he was alive. Well, finally, the psychologist hit on a plan. He presented to the man scientific evidence and medical data to prove that dead men do not bleed. And after thoroughly convincing the man that dead men do not bleed, he took out a pin and he pricked the man's finger. And when the man saw the blood trickle down his finger, his eyes grew wide, his face turned white, and he said, "Ah, dead men do bleed after all." Well, see, the point is the presupposition was so deeply ingrained that it skewed how he interpreted the evidence. And I think among many people, like especially those in radical biblical criticism, they're so deeply naturalistic that the evidence for the resurrection won't convince them. So you need to first make it plausible that there is a God of the universe, and then the evidence for the resurrection can show that this God has revealed himself in Christ. But if you're dealing with a person who isn't that hardened, then I would say go immediately to Christ. Sure. I have to say, in my experience speaking on university campuses, I find that if I give a talk that mentions Jesus in the title, like Evidence for the Resurrection of Jesus, or Who Was Jesus of Nazareth, not as many people will come to a talk like that as a talk on the existence of God. A talk on the existence of God is generic enough that it's not threatening. It doesn't sound too Christian. But a talk that is even apologetic on the evidence for Jesus, it just doesn't draw in the audience that a generic talk on God does. Yes. Yeah, I don't find many people are postmodern about science. I think that that's... let me give you my take on this, okay? Because this may be different from what some other people talk about, but I'll share my view with you. We often hear it said we live in a postmodern society or postmodern culture. I think that's a myth. I don't think we live in a postmodern culture. In fact, I think a postmodern culture is impossible. Nobody could live in a postmodern culture, as though texts don't have meaning, as though you can build a skyscraper or a bridge without reference to objective laws of physics and objective truths about the nature of the physical world. It would be impossible to live in a world with a postmodern mentality. So people, when, for example, they read the label of a bottle of medicine and the label on a box of rat poison, they believe that texts have meaning. We ignore the objective meaning of these texts at peril to our own lives. So what I find people are relativistic about is religion and ethics. Those are subjective expressions of personal taste, but they're not relativistic about science and what the deliverances of modern science tell us. On the contrary, I think most people in our culture still believe that science gives us the truth about the world and that it's ethics and religion that are just personal expressions of taste. But you see, that's not postmodernism. That's modernism. That's old line verificationism, that science and the verifiable gives you the truth about reality, and religion and ethics are just expressions of personal taste and emotions. That's nothing but old line modernism. So I think that this idea that we live in a postmodern culture, and so as a result, we must lay down our weapons of rationality, objectivity, and logic in order to meet the felt needs of people, is a satanic deception that is inviting the church to commit suicide. Because if we lay down those best weapons that we have, in the next generation, what's going to happen is Christianity will be just one more voice in a competing cacophony of voices, each sharing its own narrative, but without any kind of overarching truth or meta-narrative to commend it. So I think that this postmodernist stuff is really just the old line modernism pretending to be dead so that we think it's no longer a threat, but then coming back around in the masquerade of postmodernism, saying you don't need to worry about that old modernism anymore. You don't need to worry about logic, rationality, and evidence. And thereby get us actually to commit intellectual suicide ourselves. So in my view, I think that really the threat is the same threat that we've always had. It's modernism that is the real threat that we need to be worried about. And so in my experience in debating on campuses and so forth, I almost never get someone challenge these arguments by saying there are no objective standards of truth or rationality or scientific evidence. Rather, when I present it at this level, they meet it at this level. They respond to it in a rational way. And I think that is the strategy that we in the church need to adopt if we're going to continue to commend our faith as the objective truth about the way the world is. Yes?
A little louder.
Where he says he's a positivist. But that's just the opposite of postmodernism. I mean, positivism is this old line verificationism. What Hawking is expressing there is not postmodernism, it's instrumentalism. He's saying, I'm not a realist about science. The instrumentalist thinks that the goal of science is not to describe the way the world is. It's just to make successful predictions so that technology can advance and we can build better bridges and better electronic appliances and better rocket ships and spacecraft and so forth. And the real goal of science is just this instrumental success in mastering the world we live in. And so that's why he says, all I'm interested in is the results of measurements. But he's not a subjectivist or anything like that. He would think that there are genuine standards of theory testing, and some theories fail to meet those tests and therefore are not successful theories. But he's just not a realist is all. He thinks that we just want to get theories that succeed in making the right predictions. So don't confuse instrumentalism with postmodernism. I appreciate they sound similar because they're both anti-realist, but there's a difference in their type of anti-realism. Yes? Well, I think Roger Penrose, his colleague, would characterize himself as a realist. I think that Penrose thinks that when we do cosmology, we really are describing the way the universe actually was in the past. And our goal is to give a description of what actually happened, of the way the world really is or was, and not just to make successful predictions to advanced technology. So Penrose, I think, would be his opposite. And it's interesting, in the book that these quotations are from, The Nature of Space and Time, it is a kind of dialogue between Penrose and Hawking. And you see these two styles vividly contrasted in that very book. Yes, precisely. Newton clearly believed that he was describing the universe as it was and as God had created it. And Einstein as well, I think, definitely believed his relativity theories described the way the universe is. And in fact, that was one reason that Einstein objected to quantum theory. Quantum theory was successful in all its predictions. It never failed to predict accurately, but nevertheless, Einstein hated quantum theory because he just couldn't believe the world was really like that, that the real world involved that kind of indeterminism. Now, if he had been an instrumentalist or an anti-realist, he would have been quite happy with quantum theory because it successfully predicts all the results. But he couldn't accept it because I think he was a realist. Good examples. Thank you. Yes? Good point. Yes, the question was, when we go back to this argument, how can you have an eternal cause but a temporal effect that has a beginning? And one way to answer this might be to say an appeal to quantum theory. According to the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum theory, you can have indeterminacy. You can have spontaneous effects arise without any sort of antecedent cause. But the difficulty you see with that is that the quantum regime itself, or the quantum realm itself, comes into being in the Big Bang. And so the question is, how does that theater governed by quantum laws itself come to exist? You can't use the quantum laws to explain the origin of that theater because those laws only operate within that theater. You need to have an explanation that would bring the whole physical realm into being. Now, in a sense, the appeal to quantum fluctuation models was an attempt to do exactly what you said. The mother universe is eternal and infinite, but the many universes arise via spontaneous fluctuations. But you see, what they had to do there was you have to have the mother universe back there first to produce the quantum effects. But we've seen that model didn't work, that you've got an absolute beginning of the whole space-time realm or theater, and therefore the quantum laws that operate within that theater don't suffice to explain the origin of space and time itself. You need some non-physical, something that transcends space and time. Let's see, someone who hasn't asked a question yet, perhaps.
Uh-huh. And I just wanted to block you to apply
I do think this obviously connects up with the Christian doctrine or Judeo-Christian doctrine that human beings are made in the image of God. To be in the image of God means that we are God's representatives on this planet. When Pharaoh in ancient Egypt would send his image, this was a representation of Pharaoh's very presence. His image was the Pharaoh's presence wherever that image was. And man is God's image on this planet. Now, in order to serve as God's image, we must be personal agents like God is. So our personhood is a reflection of the personhood of the Creator of the universe. And so I do see our personhood as something that is a distinguishing mark of the image of God that separates us from all of the rest of the created order, which is impersonal and differentiated from human beings and from God in that respect. Well, the only one that I would see that we would take on would be that we have a degree of power. But certainly we're not timeless. We're temporal beings. We're not spaceless. We have material bodies that are embedded in space. We're not beginningless. Every one of us has been born, has a birthday. We're obviously not changeless. We're changing all the time. We're not necessary in our existence. We're contingent in our existence. We're not uncaused. Every one of us has a cause in our parents, as well as contemporaneous causes like the pressure, the temperature, the gravity, and so forth. So all that's left, I guess, is power, and we do have a measure of causal power. I think as free personal agents, we have the ability to cause and to do things. Indeed, here, if you like the touchy-feely things, you might want to connect with the artistic drive and intuition within human beings, that we are, like God, co-creators in art, in poetry, in music, in literature, in film. Our artistic impulse is a reflection of our creative ability that is a manifestation of God's image in us. So I guess I would see, insofar as we are personal and have a degree of power, we reflect God's image, but not the rest of those attributes. The rest of those attributes were what the old theologians used to call the incommunicable attributes of God, the attributes of God that are not communicated to his creatures and not shared with them. Well, I don't think so. I don't think any of those features of human existence would be the result of sin. I mean, just look at them. Timelessness, spacelessness, beginningless, changeless, necessity, being uncaused. I mean, none of those things are things that creatures, I don't think, physical creatures could possess, even if they were wholly sinless. So I think these truly are incommunicable attributes of God that go to exalt and magnify God. And if I might just close with that, this kind of material for me is not only valuable apologetically, I find this material is valuable personally, theologically, and devotionally. The more I have studied this, the more it has magnified my image of God and my understanding and appreciation of the doctrine of creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. And devotionally, it results in adoration and praise to a God who is so great that he could speak the universe into being by his unimaginable power. So I see this as not at all airy-fairy stuff that has no relevance to the devotional life. For the person who really understands this material, it cannot but help affect your life because of the exalted vision it gives you of who God is and how fantastic he is. So I find this to be wonderful devotional material as well as good evangelistic and apologetic information.
On that touchy-feely note. Now I have three very quick notices, and then Lars Dahl is going to make a 30-second comment on what's happened this morning, and then we're going to go for lunch. First notice is just to repeat, those of you who are here at the Apologetics Network for the first time ever, if you could get a bag lunch and then kind of sit around these front rows here just for a short while, you've obviously been thrown in at the deep end with this wonderful morning, but you may think, well, you know, where are we in all this? Is this what you do all the time? One of the things we all need to appreciate is there are some folk here who are high-end philosophers and university teachers and all the rest of it, and they've got obvious applications for this. It may be less obvious to some of us what we do with all this, but then there'll be other elements of this training track over the week that are more immediately useful for the popular end apologetic method, and the high-end lecturers and thinkers are going to be patient with us at that point. So we mustn't be too egocentric about wanting exactly what we want all the time. You know, there's a real mix here and synergy. So we digest what we can and put the bits to one side that we can't yet digest. And it really will be a wonderful feast. And if you approach it like that, you won't get indigestion. The second announcement is the film from the Discovery Institute, the Intelligent Design Guys, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, will be shown in Room D at 1:30. That's in just over 10 minutes. Bring your bag lunch. You will have first chance to purchase a copy of this DVD for €8 before the general sale. Okay, so that's Room D for Unlocking the Mystery of Life. It's a great video. It's very popular stuff about this irreducible complexity that is a key plank in the Intelligent Design Network. I think it's 40 minutes, is it? Something like that? Is it longer? No. Okay, well, just watch the first 40. If they skip the wavy bits, you know, the waves coming to the Californian beach at the beginning, I'm sure they'll knock about 10 minutes off. And the last thing is just say that Bill, I've heard Bill in debate, and I haven't heard anything quite like it. He was knocking Peter Atkins from Oxford University for 6. And I was kind of pinching myself, thinking, is this the smug Peter Atkins I've seen in the Oxford Union, actually just being left without really an apologetic? Bill does the most amazing debates. We do have some resources of Bill in debate. I'd like you to think about how you could sponsor a high-end debate, getting Bill as a guest of the university, of a philosophy faculty, so he actually comes as a proper guest of the university, to do debate. Debate is a great mechanism for many of these ideas coming out. It's more interesting, and in one sense, the relevance of it is more sharply seen when there's a protagonist. Yeah.
Greg also asked me to bring here a couple of DVDs of very recent debates that I've just had, and he suggested there might be some opportunity
to show these. We'll try and program that in, some after-hours thing.
Yeah,
I've got that noted. Thank you, Bill. So over to Lars, who's going to just give us one comment, and then we'll pray and get our lunch.
Well, thanks a lot, Bill, for what you have presented to us. I think you've... I would like to suggest that you have given us some kind of a reality check, that we are encouraged to go and check things and that have been presented, various theories against reality, whether they correspond to reality. And just occurred to me, as an educator of journalists, and there was a sentence regarding journalists and scientists, that many journalists, people, and we are all influenced by those, seem to be less interested in checking things against reality. That's a longer process. And I think that may explain why various disciplines, academic disciplines, are less concerned with the correspondence with reality criteria than, let's say, science. I mean, at least the people think so. Of course, they don't operate in reality on such a basis. So I think we need to encourage all of us to check things and to not to take things for granted, and also to encourage other people to actually ask whether things correspond to the truth that is out there. So that's just my reflection after a wonderful morning, that we're all encouraged to actually not take anything for granted, but to test things whether they are credible. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, you brought everything into being, the whole universe, and we stand in admiration and wonder. Thank you for sustaining the whole universe and for sustaining our lives. Give us true humility, give us true courage, and we pray that we will all have been stimulated and encouraged by this morning to be able to translate this into our own lives, into our own ministries, and also to enlarge, that it has enlarged our vision of who you are. We pray for each one of us, that you will give us a nice and a good conversation over lunch with someone, and that you will keep us close to you. In Jesus' name, amen.